This is R.J. Rushdoony, easy chair number 268, June 9, 1992. This evening, Otto Scott, Douglas Murray, and I will discuss now the national debt, a very big subject. As a matter of fact, it's beyond one's imagination to grasp. Economist Murray Rothbard says the national debt on budget and off budget is $20 trillion. So this means we are bankrupt. Douglas, would you like to make a general introduction to the subject?
Well, it's right that nobody understands it, otherwise people would do something about it. The national debt is never explained in practical terms that the average person really understands as to how it affects their day-to-day lives. And that seems to be the crux of the problem. That's why the politicians get away with this ever-expanding national debt, because people don't truly understand what's going to happen to them down the line. It's $4 trillion now, of the on the books portion of it.
Yes.
The current deficit, or the rate of increase, is about 350 to 400 billion. By the end of this fiscal year, it will be 500 billion. And the on-budget portion of the debt at the current rate of expansion will be $20 trillion. So obviously something has to break. It can't go on forever, because other countries are not going to accept our currency, because it's going to be worthless. So perhaps, since no one understands it, how it affects the lives of day-to-day ordinary people, we should try to approach it initially from that point of view. There have been attempts by economists to explain it, but that puts people to sleep. There's been attempts by pundits to explain the national debt by examples such as, if you piled $1 bills on top of each other, that it would form a line from here to Mars. But that still, for the average person, that doesn't do anything for them. That doesn't strike them where they live. They don't see what's going to happen. Where am I going to be a year from now, or 5 years from now, if the debt keeps expanding? So let's tackle it.
Well, simply put, if you buy a treasury bond, you have lent money to the government, and the bond is supposed to pay interest to you for a certain number of specified years. If the government puts out a whole series of bonds, these bonds are purchased either by banks or investment groups or by individuals, and the government then has to pay an interest on all this paper to whoever purchased the bonds. If you add all the bonds together, the treasury bonds of one form or another, and there's all kinds of them that cover mortgages, and they cover all areas of activity, all of which is used by the government to borrow money, both from other governments, from banks, from Wall Street, and from individuals. If the amount of that paper keeps increasing, the government bonds keep increasing, then what is called the interest on those bonds is the $450 billion that you just mentioned. We have $450 billion a year going out in interest to all the groups that purchased paper financial instruments from the government of the United States. That is the national debt. Now, when you issue a bond, you issue it for a specified number of years at a specified rate of interest. And the rate of interest at this point on government paper is lower than it has been for a number of years. But people are still holding bonds when the interest was almost 20% which they purchased under the Carter administration, which have not yet exhausted their life. So anywhere from 20% to 4.5% today is the amount of interest which is pouring, has to pour out of the Treasury. That in order to pay this interest, the government has to put out more paper each time. It is borrowing money, in other words, and not in order to pay the principal at the end of the road, but the interest year by year. At the end of the road, you cash the whole bond in, and you get the face value of the bond. The interest that you accumulated on the way is your profit. So every year there's a certain number of bonds that are cashed in, or turned over, as the phrase is, and the government puts out new bonds in order to pay the old bonds and in order to pay the interest. So you can see that the national debt feeds upon itself. This is where Murray Rothbard gets his 20 trillion. He's adding up what the bonds are worth when they're redeemed, as well as what they're worth en route to redemption. Now, these are sums. This is a method which governments have used for several hundred years. One of the greatest examples, of course, there's a lot more recent examples, but the great example for most people was the government of France in the 18th century. The government of France borrowed money in order to go to war against Great Britain on several occasions. It borrowed more money from the banks of Antwerp and Rotterdam and Amsterdam and London and so forth in order to help the American colonies. And it finally reached the point where it had put out so many bonds that the banks refused to buy any more. And that was when the government went bankrupt, and that's when they had to call the Estates General together, because the only way a government can get money when it's bankrupt is to increase the taxes. Mm-hmm. Now, we're at the point now where this has to be done. Now, in the interim, some very clever people in Washington have figured out a way around this. They are shifting the load, the tax load, from the government to private business. Private business is to pay for the health program. Private business is to pay for the pensions. Private industry is to pay for all the expenses of government. And then the government will say, we are going to reduce your taxes.
And they want them to pay for the environmental programs.
Right.
I talked a few days ago to a very fine man who has been a very faithful and generous supporter of Chalcedon over the years. And he has held executive positions. 18 months ago, he lost his job because the economy destroyed the group he was working for. Well, because the health care and pension load is shifted on to industry, he found that the only way any group could take him was to pay the difference that would have made up for his not being, say, 25 years old. So he said, who's going to make up the differences in industry and catch me up? So he said, I find that as a white male of 50, I am unemployable. It's too high a price for industry to pay to take me on.
The government has mandated these payments.
Yes. And he said, they could be compelled to take me on if I were black or a female.
Yes.
But he said, a white Christian male? He said at the unemployment office, there was a very helpful woman who told him very frankly, she said, the thing for you to do is to run out on your wife and then I can get a job for her.
The
great
a contractor.
That's a great solution.
This healthcare thing really is a vicious anti-family piece of legislation. And illustrate this, a local contractor told me that he cannot afford to hire a married male over 34 years old. He has to get virtually kids right out of school and use them in his business for 5 to 8 years, and then he has to cut them adrift. Otherwise, he can't keep them employed. He cannot afford the health care insurance.
Well, let's go back to the government debentures, the government obligations. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae, two government agencies, have accepted the mortgages of many millions of people at varying rates of interest. Now, they forced a lot of this onto the banks. They guarantee the banks, so the banks have taken up the mortgage. If the mortgages fall below a certain level, the level of return, let us say, and they go into a state of debit, the people will not pay the mortgage because it isn't worth what they're living in. The Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae will go belly up, just like the savings and loan guarantees, because there isn't that much money in the country, no matter how much money we have. One of the things that's been saving the government from the crunch is the fact that the overseas dollars are not being returned to this economy. They're being locked up or they're being used as currency by other countries. And this is the euro dollars. Dollars are used in Argentina. Dollars are being used in Russia. You wonder where they got all the dollars in Russia, where they got them. But in any event, what we have floated here is a sort of a Ponzi scheme. We have borrowed from the world over and over and up and up. And the whole world now is our creditor. And if we fall, they all fall with us.
Yes.
Well, if an individual uses this system that the government uses, they go to prison.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
What we need is a special prosecutor to go after the government.
Well,
this Ponzi scheme.
Whenever you have a debt, someone pays.
Oh, yes.
Someone always pays. If the debtor doesn't pay, then the lender does. And sometimes when the government is involved, it's an innocent third party who pays. To illustrate, and I can think of several cases of this immediately, of people who called and talked to me and others as well. Let's assume there is someone in New York. His wife is in process of getting a divorce and she comes to California. She gets a job here. He has been a man who's made money but has not paid his taxes properly, so the IRS cannot get it out of him. He's got it all concealed or hidden. They can come and seize her meager earnings. Or they can take what belongs to her family and which she has inherited that she might have inherited while they were still married. This is the brutality of the situation. Now, more than one country in this century has defaulted, has refused to pay its debts, and has simply said, we don't owe anyone anything. But what happens is that someone loses.
Yeah, but you notice the common denominator element is that it's anti-family, traditional values or Christian values.
Well, what they will do, you see, they seize everybody's bank accounts. This has been done repeatedly. Their insurance money, their pension funds, everything.
Well, look what Gorbachev did. He pulls in all the 50 rubles.
Yes.
He declared them worthless overnight. So all the savings of all those people were overnight declared of no value.
Stalin did that once earlier.
Now, of course, defaulting, Philip II defaulted three times in the course of his reign. Defaulting is the oldest thing that a government does. The other oldest thing that they do is to debase the currency,
mm-hmm.
or inflate, whatever you call it. What is really at stake here when you have a government that cannot meet its obligations without raiding the private sector is that the government is eating up the seed capital of the nation and forcing worthless paper onto the banks. This is why the banks are in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Our banks were not so stupid as to lend all this money overseas with the expectation that it would be paid. They knew that it wouldn't. They were pressed by Washington, D.C. into making those loans because the government said, we guarantee them and we insist that you make them.
So they nationalized the banks.
Yes. In effect, they've nationalized the banks. They've also nationalized the auditors. And they're in the process of trying to nationalize the attorneys.
Back in the 1930s, for every teaching job that opened in Los Angeles, there were as many as 5,000 applicants from all over the West. The pay was regarded as sensational, $150 a month.
Well, that was a great, nice job.
Yes. And it was towards the end of the 30s, I think when the 30s ended, my father, at no small sacrifice, provided me with a gift, $100 bond. Now, that, when 150 was good pay, was big money. It was early in the 50s I began to realize that $100 bond was not worth as much anymore. So I cashed it in immediately. Now, if someone had collected quite a few $100 bonds and put them away, as some people did, consider what in time they would have found. They had thrown their money down the drain. They had been robbed.
Well, they used to promote bonds as a means of funding college education.
Mm-hmm.
And it was dishonest all the way down the line, because by the time your kids grew up, the money wouldn't cover the education.
That's right.
Well, this is what's happening to all the people who have treasury bonds. My mother went through that. She bought $80,000 worth of war bonds in 1942 at 3.5%. When she died in 1982, we cashed them in. We didn't know she had them. And, you know, she never even cashed them in.
And yet today, you can, there are dozens of these investment newsletters, and the quotes more conservative ones, the ones who feel that they're safe investments, say that treasury paper is the place to be.
Oh, yes.
Because of the full faith and
final
credit
security
of the U.S. government.
The final security, but the pension funds that have gone into it. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there's a great deal of outcry about what corporations are doing with the pension funds. It's the corporation's duty is to earn money with the pension funds. You understand that if the pension fund is left untouched, it's not in cash. It's always in the form of stocks or bonds. And they have to earn money with the pension funds in order to keep up the payments of the pension. because if they don't, they won't be able to continue those payments. Well, when you have continuing inflation, which we have, and when you have a stock market which is out of control and totally irrational, what are you going to do with your pension funds? A lot of companies went into what we call junk bonds because the junk bonds had a higher yield. Now, it's true that they were more speculative because if they had to give you more interest than something that was a blue chip bond. But if you wanted to bring in enough money to keep your pension funds going, you had to go into these more speculative bonds. When the government moved in against the junk bond field, what they called a junk bond, they forced the banks to sell them overnight. That's what caused the SNL collapse. And that's what caused the banks to get into trouble. So we have the government manipulating on all sides of the fence.
You know, the junk bond thing was predicated on an expanding economy, which
yes.
they could convince people of during the 80s.
That's right, because the economy was expanding. So what comes next in this discussion? The crash.
Mm-hmm.
We have here a situation very similar to the French situation in the close of the 18th century. We have a rich country, we have what amounts to a rich populace, and we have an increasingly impoverished government which is drawing its riches from the people in various forms. It's closing down the investment market on one hand with its free trade policies and also with its EPA policies and so forth. And at the same time, it's dragging in all the money it can by putting out more and more bond issues. We would call them junk bonds if we were telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of France, it led to revolution. Here, what do you suppose would happen? We have no idea. But we know that we can't continue.
Yes, and the most horrifying fact is neither Bush nor Clinton nor Perot
is discussing it.
Or seems to be even remotely aware of it.
They're not talking about it. They're not telling the people the situation, and I'm not even sure they understand the situation.
No, I don't think they do. They act as though all that is necessary is for Congress to pass some kind of legislation and it will solve the problem.
Well, I often think that they really know what's coming, but they're hoping it won't happen on their watch.
Huh.
And the Congress, you know, it's kind of interesting to me that Congress has become more corrupt as far as grabbing what they can for themselves, and that to me indicates that the game is about up because they see it coming and they're going to get what they can get while they can get it.
Well, it's like saying, just give me a higher seat in the lifeboat.
Well, you know, the choices are kind of limited. You can have an inflationary depression where the government prints an unending stream of money to the point where nobody will accept it, or you can have a deflationary depression, which I think Howard Ruff described once as a choice between a car going over a cliff with the foot on the accelerator or the foot on the brake. But you're going over the cliff one way or the other.
Well, suppose they were to revalue gold. I'm positive that they're sitting on the price of gold.
Yes.
The central banks are buying gold and swapping gold all the time. But none of those large transactions ever seem to affect the price of gold in the marketplace. They're not even counted as existing. So we have an artificial price of gold. But suppose that the government gold now is down to $338. Say down to, I remember when $35 for 25 or 30 years.
They call it the London fix, by the way.
It is a London fix. They fix it every morning before breakfast because it'll turn, you know, they'll throw their food up if they wait after breakfast. At any rate, if they were to say, okay, American gold is now worth X dollars, the gold that we presumably have in the government, suddenly there would be, and if they fixed it to the dollar, there would be some sort of yardstick where you could begin to make economic sense. As it is, you have to read the paper every day to find out what the dollar is worth. Now, this is like changing the inch or the yard or the mile, the dimensions of these figures, and running an engineering company. I mean, you can't do it. If your prime unit of measurement fluctuates, then you cannot have a stable economic structure.
Well, there's a big contradiction floating out there. A lot of the politicians and some running for president seem to feel that the way to pay off the national debt is to earn your way out of it by expanding the economy. But if, as forecast in by within the next 5 years, the government will consume 90% or more of the total credit available. Now, when that happens, you can't expand an economy because nobody can borrow any money to start a business when you're in competition with the government to get at it.
Almost every day I get checks and notices from credit card companies offering me more credit. I'm worth more on paper now than I've ever been worth in my life. If I were to draw upon it, I don't know how I would ever pay it back.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're counting on people's still having the mindset that we're living in an inflationary economy. But it's obviously beginning to deflate.
I think the economy is deflating, but not the currency. The money is inflating.
Yeah, but that
productivity is false.
Yes. Yeah, the money or the availability of money maintains the perception that that the lenders want to maintain.
Mm-hmm. So we have profits, rising profits and falling productivity. Now, in the end, what are we going to do for making our goods to keep ourselves alive? Mm-hmm. I just bought a chair, an office chair. My old one finally wore out. It was made in China. Practically all my clothes come from some other part of the world.
It's hard to find anything that's made here anymore.
I was moved to remember something today. During the Carter years, when we had dramatic inflation, I was talking to an accountant who said that he was donating his services freely, making out the returns of a number of people who had retired when Gerald Ford was president and thought they had a good pension. But with the march of inflation so dramatically under Carter, they couldn't make ends meet, and they were having to skimp. Well, everything doubled in the 80s, so consider what that did. And in the 90s, it is going to be even worse.
Well, these people, a couple of decades ago, could sell their house.
Yes.
Because in most cases they own their house by the time they retired. They could sell their house at a fairly decent profit and move into something smaller. But what happens if you can't sell a house?
Well, the value drops.
Well, the value drops. You own the house, but your taxes keep going up.
Yes.
Your county taxes keep going up. And we've also seen that case, which I'll never forget, Rush, about that county in Colorado that went bankrupt, and suddenly they hit the house owners with $20,000 and $30,000 bills in order to pay the bills of the county.
And never gave us the follow-up on that story.
And we never found out what happened after
that.
But you know, the county is capable of doing that. It has the legal authority to do it.
Yes. Well, and people who vote for bond issues in their county don't realize that that can happen to them.
If the bond issue collapses?
Yes. Well, we'll continue with this. Otto, you were going to say something about repudiation of debt.
Yes. Dorothy reports that Murray Rothbard says it's the only way we can extricate ourselves from this debacle. I recall that various countries have done this, and of course it destroys their international credit for generations to come. Latin American countries have gone through repudiation when there's a change of government. The Soviet Union, of course, repudiated all the czarist debts, I mean, as a result of revolution or internal overthrow or whatever. So you were then barred from the international markets for an indefinite period of time. But don't forget, in this instance, much of our internal debt is owed to the people. So the repudiation of our debt would wipe out all kinds of pensioners and all kinds of American investors.
Rothbard is aware of that, and he says we are going to repudiate. And he feels that what we should work for is to get the federal government to sell off its assets so that it will pay off the national debt by selling off the national forests, the national parks,
to private interests.
To private interests. And he feels that since the federal government has accumulated such vast properties in all 50 states, selling these off will more than take care of the national debt.
Well, in that case, he parallels what Peter Ball, a retired investment banker I know in San Diego, had told me 20 years ago, mm-hmm. that the government has enough assets to match its debts if it would turn them loose. Mm-hmm. But of course, here you would have every one of these agencies which make a living monitoring the use of these assets out of business. What we're really talking about when it comes right down to the crunch would be a reorganization of our government. Mm-hmm. Now, in the previous tape, we talked about a new constitution because that's what Mr. Perot wants. But I don't think a new constitution is necessary. I think the old constitution should be restored.
Yes.
Which prevented the government from owning all these assets.
Originally, they were only allowed, 10 square miles?
They were only allowed post offices and forts.
Yes, and...
And an area 10 miles square for...
Military bases.
For government buildings.
Yes. The Constitution forbade the ownership by the federal government in the states of anything more than that.
I've never forgotten your talk about the king's property. The deer parks,
yes.
Which was put in by the Norman, William yes. the Conqueror,
yes.
who took over all the free lands of England and called them crown properties. This government has done the same thing.
Yes.
We have spotted owl parks and snail darter parks. And
they've used the sovereign authority the way an absolute king used to do it.
By decree.
Mm-hmm. They gave themselves the authority, and a cowardly court, which is under the thumb of Congress, has permitted them to do it.
One of the things that I think we need to be mindful of is this. There has never been an advance in the history of civilization that has not been preceded by a greater productivity in farming. And whenever productivity in farming has, for any reason, been throttled, civilization nosedives. Because we're tied to the land, we're tied to food. And what we are seeing all over the world is a steady throttling of productivity in agriculture. The Soviet Union is a classic example of what happens when that takes place. And they destroyed their own future when they did it. The Ukraine was once the breadbasket of Europe under the Tsars, and it became, like all of Russia, a poor area. Stalin forcibly starved 6 to 13 million peasants to break the backbone of the resistance of the farmers.
There's some argument today that he didn't intend to starve them all. He really just intended to reform the agricultural situation. And in the process, he starved them. Now, I don't know whether that's considered an excuse or not.
Sounds like revisionism to me.
It is revisionism, because you know the Marxists have not yet given up at all. They have not surrendered.
No. I have somewhere in my library Stalin's speech when the enforced collectivization and the famine took place in the 30s. And he fully recognized what had happened, but he blamed it on two eager underlings, as though any underling would have dared to do anything like that without direct orders from him.
Well, you are, I think, hitting on a very central nerve when you talk about curtailing production as a result of governmental regulations, mm-hmm. whether it's, of course, all wealth comes from the land, mm-hmm. everything, all our commodities, and everything that we manufacture comes ultimately from the land. But what worked in what certain periods of national growth doesn't always work if continued beyond the point of diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. Free trade never worked. Mm-hmm. And the South is a pretty good example of the argument that it should have been instituted and it wasn't. But in any event, every great power that has gone into finance at the expense of production has destroyed itself.
Yes. Well, this is exactly what we've done as far as industry is concerned, and what we are in process of doing insofar as farming is concerned. Because we had a measure on the ballot that in the last election would have wiped out farming here, because it would have barred anything that they felt was not natural. It would have barred certain kinds of chemicals and pesticides.
Oh, I see. They're unnatural.
Yes. And it would have killed the most productive area in the world, California farming.
Well, you know, of course, that the L.A. riots hit the largest industrial concentration
yes.
in the country that remains. Yes. Mm-hmm. It was our last large industrial concentration. It was a mass of small industries.
Yes.
And those riots were a heavy blow to the economy of the United States. Mm-hmm. Not one newspaper mentioned that aspect.
Mm-hmm. Well,
whom the gods would destroy, their first drive mad.
Yes. We have seen every great movement forward marked first by a productivity in agriculture and then a productivity in industry. Man is food-based in his daily life.
Everything is based on work.
Mm-hmm.
Without work, what have you got?
Yes.
And it's interesting to see the decline from generation to generation, from the men who built factories and turned out goods and operated farms to the sons who went into the professions.
Yes.
Now, professions don't keep us alive. The law doesn't keep us alive. And these caring professions, as they call them, the social therapists, are saddling us with expenses that bankrupt us if we get sick. And everyone gets sick.
Mm-hmm. In other words, we made a mistake generationally when we sent our kids to college.
Well, I'm sorry to say we did. We had a great American. We substituted schooling for aristocracy. And the aristocrats were never notable for their schooling.
Craig Flanagan has a friend in Los Angeles, now retired, who lived in Beverly Hills. He was a Scot, a hard-headed, thrifty man. And he said to his friends, if your boys are ready to work and to work hard, I can ensure that they get rich, but they're going to have to forget about college and come with me. I'll teach them how. No takers.
No takers.
No takers. Well, he has demonstrated again and again that he can do it. It just takes a little entrepreneurial spirit.
Well, we have now a problem because we've moved into the Mandarin era.
Yes.
The Mandarins were given official positions because of their learning. And you can't really get very far in government without the entree of the degree and so forth. John Major seems to have survived in England without one, but there actually is more upward mobility in Britain than there is in the United States today. We were once famous for allowing the common man to rise to his natural level. That's no longer true.
That's the reason people used to come here. Now they come here to collect welfare.
Well, they come to share in the riches of the country, but they will flee in equal numbers if we get into trouble. Mm-hmm. Economic settlers are not the best.
Yeah, but as the L.A. riot showed, they'll destroy the place before they leave town.
I was told by a man in Pittsburgh who has a son in L.A. that his son saw the riots. And he said, the media misled us because it only showed the street people. He said, actually, people of all levels joined in the looting. He said, men in three-piece suits, whole families drove up in big automobiles to take part in the stealing.
Feeding frenzy. Well, the Attorney General's reported that a third of the people arrested were illegal aliens.
Well, that's adding to our internal debt, isn't it?
Yes.
Because we have to support many of these people. And they don't pay taxes.
We are to give them every kind of health insurance. We are to care for them. We cannot send them back. Our immigration service is hamstrung at every turn.
Well, it's an augmentation of foreign aid.
Mr. Perot wants to stop Social Security payments beyond a certain income level. And I said, does he plan to give back the money?
Yes.
And apparently that hasn't occurred to him, that this was a contract.
Yes.
With the people who paid Social Security. I paid it from the time it was enacted.
Well, they're going to kiss goodbye to most of it.
I'm sure.
I never see it. Well, Burkett talked about... there's a $600 billion pool of money in the private retirement accounts, and he thinks that the government's going to sweep that in Social Security when they get their back to the wall.
Yes, of course they will. Well, when they get their back to the wall, they're going to take everything you and I have if they can do it. Well, I think we ought to look at the brighter side of it now for a while.
There is one?
Well, I think... the federal government is a dead duck. They're bankrupt. So they're not going to clutter the landscape too long. And the same goes for all the European countries, the Far Eastern countries, and more. Japan is about the only solvent one. They don't have a national debt.
Well, they allowed the people savings.
Yes.
Now, our savings are very low because... what we would ordinarily have saved had been taken away from us in taxes. and what's left is just about enough to keep us going.
Now, the Japanese did intentionally keep their tax rate very low.
They kept their tax rate low, and they also exempted savings.
We've exempted housing, what you put into a house. So if you equate the two, the average American has saved as much
in his house.
In his house as the Japanese have in the bank. The only difference is we're taxing the house.
Yes.
And we're taxing it at a greater and greater rate across the country. So we're striking at people's savings there.
It's getting to the point where it will be cheaper to rent than it will be to own a house. The deflation that's going on now, which is we're seeing in the northeastern part of the country, there are people back there who are abandoning homes that they put a lot of money into because the amount they owe on the mortgage is more than the current market value of the house.
Well, don't forget, Bureau came out of nowhere, and despite the fact that he's made some very wild statements about what he thinks he would do, he has rendered already a very valuable service in that he has rendered both the Republican and Democratic parties hollow.
Mm-hmm.
And he's proven that they're hollow. He's also proven, Pat Buchanan also proved the conservative movement was hollow just by emerging.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once you break Humpty Dumpty, once the mystique is gone of the rulers, the governing elite, and it's in the process of destroying its own mystique, then the game changes and all kinds of new individuals begin to appear, Perot being simply one of the first. Others will appear. I think that Perot has done Howie Phillips a great unintended favor, because Howie is trying to put together a small intellectual party based upon Christian principles.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that no matter how this election goes, he says he's going to continue this for the rest of his life. He's going to have an alternative, an intelligent alternative to the dementia that we may see.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I'm more hopeful now than I was, let us say, 6 months ago. Because once the gates of change swing open, there is a fighting chance.
Yes. Well, I agree with you. I think what has happened this year shows that the Republicans and Democrats are bankrupt. And people are increasingly ashamed of what they represent. I think that we are going to see that disillusionment increase. I think, however, before the people expect too much from any leader that emerges, they've got to demand more of themselves. The bankruptcy begins with the people. They have drifted from Christian faith. They have settled for a kind of minimal Christianity, which is no Christianity at all. They are morally bankrupt. The overwhelming majority of church members, as I pointed out in a tape about a year ago, and these are those who profess to be Bible believing, don't believe more than 4 of the 10 commandments. So they are really bankrupt, morally bankrupt. Now, this has to change. I do believe a change is developing on the grassroots level. So I am encouraged. I think it's going to be grim for the rest of this decade, but I think signs of a new country will emerge.
Well, I heard from a fellow a couple of days ago who lives in Virginia, who's been attending some religious gatherings of a fundamentalist nature. And he said that when he began to attend them, they were something like 40 or 50. He said now they are in the hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
And he said nobody seems to know it, but there is an awakening.
Yes. Well, the media would never acknowledge it,
no,
but it's very real. It's very real.
Well, how do people survive in the meantime during this period? What practical measures can they take to try to minimize the pain?
I think they need to get out of debt. They need to have some gold and silver. They need to think in terms of a crisis that is developing. And they need, above all else, to deepen their spiritual roots.
In the last depression, the last Great Depression of the 30s, there were an awful lot of governmental activities were just quite simply ignored. There were an awful lot of people who helped each other. Almost everyone I knew that had a job had somebody sleeping on the sofa at night who
yes.
needed a job. There were at Prohibition, you know, when the Depression started, I can't tell you how many home brews were sold in private homes, how many housewives were making beer on the side. And there were all kinds of expedients going on.
Nobody took baths?
People took baths.
Bathtubs were full of this brew.
Oh, no, they didn't use it in bathtubs. They had regular barrels and so forth. Mm-hmm. In fact, there were stores that sold hops, remember?
Yes.
And they sold stills.
Well, it's interesting, too, that crime dropped with the Depression. And people went back to church. Families doubled up, as Otto said. Every sofa had somebody sleeping on it.
Even the movies got religious.
Yes, they did. Very definitely. It was a back-to-basics time.
There are worse things than losing your money.
Mm-hmm. It was surprising, too, how many people had their power turned off. And I only knew one person who was broken up and cried over it, and she had been very wealthy. And she was a widow. Her oldest son had laid waste everything. And she cried. But others took it in their stride.
Well, what else can you do?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like wartime. Do you know
yes.
the suicide rate drops?
Yes.
And there is a common cause, and all of a sudden the disparities in circumstances cease to have the exaggerated influence and status that they have in good times. All of a sudden nobody says, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? Because nobody's rich anymore.
Another aspect to the Depression. People enjoyed laughing. That was the time when the great radio comics developed. Jack Benny, Fred Allen, and a great many others.
It was amazing. They had these comedy movies about
yes.
wealthy people, and you would have thought that the audience would throw stones at the screen. They didn't. They thought
no.
it was just marvelous.
I think George Burns plans to go through this whole next cycle.
he very well may.
I'm
surprised that he hasn't issued his Secret of Longevity.
Well, he says he's waiting to get to 100 because after 100, the death rate is very low. But George Burns and Gracie Allen were one among many, many comedians of that era. It was quite a time. In fact, the most popular newspaper commentator was Will Rogers, a comedian.
That's true. He was more of a wit than a comedian.
Yes.
But what we're saying is that life goes on, and that the importance that's attached to the material circumstances has been greatly exaggerated. The government will suffer more than the people unless they pull their socks up.
Yes.
Because We've seen the dissolution of the political structure of the Soviet Union, the world's largest empire, just in the last couple of years. And why these people think they're going to survive a debacle, I don't know.
Well, our time is nearly up. I'd like to add one more thing. I mentioned Will Rogers, and it brought to mind something he said about the media. They still quote him to the effect that all I know is what I read in the papers, but they don't quote what he said at another time. All I know is what I don't read in the papers, which is closer to the truth.
Well, it was a great put-down of people who got everything they knew from the papers.
Yes.
I mean, it's like Lincoln's comment about the common man. He said God must have loved him. He made so many of them. Mm-hmm. And I never thought of that as a compliment to the common man.
Well, I think our time is over. Thank you all for listening, and God bless you.